Who you put your trust in matters. Investors have put their trust in independent registered investment advisors to the tune of $4 trillion. Why? Learn more at findyourindependentadvisor.com. Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene with David Gura. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on iTunes, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
Donald Trump's victory triggered a sell-off in global bonds and emerging market assets while the dollar rose. Now we're seeing some of those post-election moves scale back as investors assess whether they're overreacting to Trump's victory. Now for more, we're very pleased to welcome Alex Salmond. He is the former First Minister of Scotland. Good morning.
Good morning.
Holger Schmieding, Chief Economist at Berenberg, also joins us. Holger, thank you for joining us. Alex, let me start off with you, right? What does a Donald Trump victory mean to you? Is this the end of austerity? Is this actually inequality? How do you explain it? Because if you can explain it, it means that he has a clear mandate to do what exactly?
Well, I don't think anybody knows. I mean, obviously the campaign rhetoric employed by the Donald is very frightening to lots of people, to Mexican, to Muslims, perhaps to gays, to minorities. And you see some of that reaction. It's not just disappointment. There's fear in that reaction. In more international terms, then I think it's a balance between an expansionary domestic policy in the economy, but also the threat of protectionism, which in international affairs and trade. Now, I mean, there's a few things which are absolutely cast iron laws in economics, but one of them is that protectionism makes everybody poorer. The less international trade you have, the less freedom of trade you have, the more poor people
become. And yet, this is where the world is going.
Well, there's a lot of protectionist forces. I mean, it's one of the natural populist instincts, and it's usually the job of politicians to resist that populist instinct for the greater good. So you've got the balance between an expansionary policy to restore the broken infrastructure of the United States on the one hand, but the looming threat of protectionism, which certainly will absolutely make everybody poorer, including the dispossessed, the disappointed of the United States, who Donald Trump was meant to be appealing to.
Alex, help me here with my observation that London has barely been affected by Brexit. How is Brexit, the initial days here, the initial weeks, how has it affected Scotland?
Well, there hasn't been a dramatic effect, but of course, you know, we're in London, so
right.
It's a bit like jumping off the post office tower and halfway down saying, well, we're all right so far. You haven't hit the ground yet. There hasn't been a Brexit. In Scotland,
right.
It would be jumping off the Scott Monument in Edinburgh, being halfway down and saying, we're all right so far. So we don't know. I mean, the difficulty, I think, that is looming in the economy is there's a growing realization that the UK government doesn't know either. And the indication that there's no clear strategy will affect real economic variables.
And Francine, that sets us up for our next segment on Brexit. But really, today to me is almost currency dynamics.
Yeah, it's currency dynamics. It's also, again, to Alex's point, you know, about protectionism. If you're in Europe, and Holger, I know you've held the view, the German view, for quite some time, right? And Angela Merkel has been the beacon of stability for 11 years. How does she fight this current wave of populism, which brings a lot of things with it? How we cope with immigration, how we cope with trade deals, how we cope with open borders.
First of all, I fully agree with what we just heard. Protectionism is the real risk here. So far, policymakers around the Western world have held the line. We have not had an increase in protectionism yet, but now with the Brexit vote and Donald Trump, there is a risk of protectionism rising. The German position is very clear. Germany did the hard labor market reforms 10, 12 years ago. As a result, it has record employment, it has a strong domestic situation, and as a result, populists in Germany are at around 15, 14%. They are not close to anywhere where they are in the UK or the US.
But Holger, clearly, we spoke to a couple of the Trump advisors, David Malpass, Mr. Navarro, and Peter Navarro was very clear. He believes that any country with a surplus, and he mentioned Germany, he talked about China, any country with a surplus is cheating America in trade deals.
That is just wrong economics, period. Simply wrong. Any sort of second-year student of economics or first-year student of economics should know that is wrong. If you look at the German data, what you see is pensions are rising 4%, government spending is rising 4% year over year, private consumption is fairly strong. You cannot simply accuse the Germans of underspending. Wrong.
All right, we have... Sorry, Alex, I need to interrupt.
It was worked out some time ago.
Alex, hold that thought, because we're just getting the former French finance minister, Emmanuel Macron, who's just said he's running for president. Now, we're seeing live pictures from Bobigny. Tom, this is north of Paris. I think it's about 45 minutes from Paris. We had covered him extensively when he's talking about reforms. Again, remember, there's a presidential election. I'm losing my voice, Tom, but there's a presidential election in France next year. The markets need to decide whether they believe the polls. There is certainly someone from the far right, who's Marine Le Pen, who is much more palatable than her father ever was, but with anti-Europe stance, anti-immigration stance. Macron is not from that camp. He's very young. He's about 39
years old. But it's a crowded field is the answer.
It's a crowded field of where Macron wants to be, right? He's a socialist. So if you look at the left, it's a crowded field.
Let's rip up the script right now. We see this important moment for France. Alex Salmon, you've seen this before, and it's almost a new populism. Did Mr. Trump, and frankly other elections, did they change the traditional calculus of voting across Europe?
Well, I think it'd be very adventurous after Brexit and after Trump to state that Marine Le Pen is not going to have a chance of winning the French presidential election. However, you would say that the electoral system in France kind of mitigates against it because they have a knockout system which goes to a runoff. In other words, you couldn't, for example, win a presidential election in France without winning the popular vote, like Mr. Trump did. I could also say that, you know, Scotland's quite interesting here. Scotland is a country where the insurgent party, the SNP, the one who's become dominant, is actually a very progressive party, both in terms of international trade but in terms of domestic politics. So it's not a given that parties which are against the establishment have to be protectionist in terms of their attitude to the world or, for that matter, divisive
but you had
in terms
your
of domestic policy.
Right, you had your referendum which settled it.
Yeah, well,
last year.
Well, yeah, I mean, look, since it was 2 years ago, but since then,
2 years ago,
you know, the SNP's won 56 out of 59 Westminster seats in the elections, and the SNP have been returned
in
the domestic elections.
Yeah, I'd just like to emphasize one point here. If we look at France, we find that among the most popular politicians in that country, on the center right, Juppé, a reformer, Fillon, a reformer. On the center left, Macron, Valls, an economic reformer. So while there's a lot of talk about Le Pen and there is a tail risk, the real interesting thing in France is reformers are actually
popular. By reform, do you mean a more Anglo-Saxon model?
I mean a more Angela Merkel,
economic
reforms and stability.
Okay, but hold on.
Can I steal that phrase?
You can totally steal it. With royalties, so you have to pay a premium to Holger every time you use it. I think we're also seeing live pictures of Marine Le Pen, who's actually rebranded her movement and doesn't want to be called Marine Le Pen anymore. She wants to be called Marine the Problem, Holger, and then I'll ask Alex the same thing. She's opening her headquarters in Paris there, Tom, is that Alain Juppé has been around forever.
Yeah.
Right? He's been in politics for, what, 60 years?
Yes.
And so if you see a wave of people wanting something new, then he's a favorite currently, but he may not be the right person.
Well, actually, he would be, because when he was prime minister, he was the one who actually instituted reforms, and then it was his president, Chirac, who did not back him up against street protests. But so his record is that he actually wants to persevere, wants to do reforms, and if president, he would.
Well, that's a reasonable point, but remember, and this supports it, that in France, by definition, you come up against the strongest candidate. Because of the knockout system, Le Pen will face the strongest alternative candidate. Arguably, that didn't happen in the United States.
Right. I mean, it reminds me of 2002. I was covering the French elections then, Tom, and her father, Jean-Marie Le Pen, you know, came out of nowhere to that second round of the presidential elections.
Always driving the conversation in international relations is, without question, the gentleman who invented it out of the Washington consensus. Joseph Nye, of course, at the Harvard Kennedy School. His Power in Interdependence is the iconic text. Professor Nye, wonderful to have you with us. How do you define Trump foreign policy?
Well, Tom, it's early. We don't know, based on the campaign, which of the contradictory statements is going to be operational. But I would say on security policy, he's more likely to stay on course. On trade policy, I think you're going to have radical changes, the end of TPP and TTIP and so forth. So a mixed bag and still unpredictable. Right.
The backdrop from your wonderful monograph of a year ago, your smaller size book, which I claimed was a must read, and your reaffirmation in Project Syndicate the other day is on your optimism on the nation. Let's go to the quote, call it my morning must read for this morning, this from Professor Nye, and it's real simple. We oscillate between triumphalism and declinism. The U.S. is not in decline. Finally, Professor Nye goes on to say there is Russia, a country in decline. Mr. Trump is correct to avoid the complete isolation of Russia, with which we have overlapping interests. No one could gain from a Cold War. Professor Nye, how should Mr. Trump discuss, act, and behave with Mr. Putin?
Well, he's got a double task. One is he doesn't want to undercut the sanctions which tell Putin that you can't steal your neighbor's territory by force, as he did with Ukraine. On the other hand, we do have business to do with the Russians. Iran, Afghanistan, North Korea, the Arctic. There are lots of things where we, and of course Syria and the Middle East, lots of things where we have to do business. So he's got to have a business-like relationship, which is, of course, what he prides himself in, but at the same time, not let Putin off the hook in regard to his aggression against Ukraine.
Professor, I love what you wrote. Forget soft power. The U.S. risks losing hard power, right? I mean, if they're retrenching, if they're becoming much more inward-looking, you could also see the Chinese, forcing the rest of the world to adopt the renminbi as a reserve currency. Do you think there's a real possibility that 4 years from now, the U.S. loses real power?
I doubt that you're going to see the renminbi as the reserve currency. You have to have deep and flexible capital markets and a real rule of law before a currency becomes a dominant reserve currency. China's a long way from that. And in terms of a hard military power, Trump has said that he is going to invest in that area. So I think we're actually likely to lose more in the terms of soft power. People who want to follow our values because of the rhetoric we're using,
right.
I doubt we're going to lose a lot in hard power, either economic or military capability.
Right. Professor, what are your values? Are the values under this presidency going to be the same as they were 10 years ago?
I believe in democracy. I believe in tolerance toward people, a certain openness, and those are issues which have been questioned in the campaign. I hope that that the president-elect is going to reaffirm them, as many people have urged him to do.
Professor Nye, you have a chapter in your classic book, Coping with Interdependence. Help us here with President Trump and how he needs to cope with a new Westphalian world, how he needs to cope with, as Fareed Zakaria says, a hub-and-spoke system. There's a new calculus here. How does a president cope with that?
Well, for 70 years since Harry Truman's day, the United States has had a system of alliances which has provided stability and security, and every market requires a political framework of security for itself, for it to flourish. And if Trump undercuts those alliances, then you're going to see the spillover into the prospects for markets and growth. I think if you look at his initial statements since the last week's election, he's tended to be reaffirming on those alliances. He complains about NATO not paying enough for its own defense, but so did previous presidents, and he has at least so far authorized the view that we will defend the NATO partners.
Yeah. This is what we love about Bloomberg Surveillance. Joseph Nye with us, and also joining us today, Jim O'Neill, of course, with his service to Goldman Sachs and then to the United Kingdom. Mr. O'Neill, you hear Professor Nye there talking about interdependence and the new calculus. Help me here with how the United Kingdom fits into a new Trump foreign policy.
So
Nigel Farage, I believe, is stepping in on this debate.
It's great to be on the same session as somebody like Joe. So I had the pleasure of chatting to him about the BRIC world in the past. So I find my mind thinking that this is just the whole Trump development is a further step on the path to an increasingly complex world. And a couple of other things that, you know, for the UK, and I think you've seen the Chancellor articulate it reasonably well at the, we just had the so-called economic and functional dialogue with China. And he was pretty clear, because he was quizzed directly about that, as the, you know, the number one finance guy in this country. We have to, we're a very small open country, and especially post-Brexit, we have to have as good a relationships with the US as we can, but we have to be probably even more on the front foot with some of these newer guys like China.
Help our US audience here. Does Nigel Farage help with that conversation? Or is he an obstructionist?
You know, that is something for the tactics of the policymakers to focus on. What is really important for the underlying and long-term health of the UK, we need to be on the front foot with the likes of a China, despite some of the obvious challenges that creates, because we need to be in the centre of global trade flows more than we have successfully been in the past, and we have to remain in the center of global capital flows. And whilst that raises some challenges for us, as we saw in things I was involved in with policy, we were one of the earliest participants in the Asian Infrastructure Bank. I was there for the signing
of
it.
But Jim, you know China like no other. Does antagonizing or playing tough guy with China work?
Listen, I'll go back to what I said about the dollar. I remember all this stuff in the early 80s about beating up on Japan, and it, you know, it never really happened.
Who you put your trust in matters. Investors have put their trust in independent registered investment advisors to the tune of $4 trillion. Why? They see their role as to serve, not sell. That's why Charles Schwab is committed to the success of over 7,000 independent financial advisors who passionately dedicate themselves to helping people achieve their financial goals. Learn more at findyourindependentadvisor.com.
Let me bring in now Charles Weiplatz, professor of international economics at the Graduate Institute of International and Development Studies in Geneva, on a day when President Obama is speaking about democracy in Athens, preparing to head to Germany after that to meet with the Chancellor of Germany, Angela Merkel. Let's start in France. We're reaching you in France today, Professor Weiplatz. Emmanuel Macron's declaring his candidacy in France this morning. What does that say to you about what's going on in France? Indeed, what's going on in Europe, him declaring his candidacy?
Well, generally in Europe, as you know, there is also a Trump-like phenomenon happening. All sorts of strange populists are climbing in public opinion polls. Next month, we have a referendum in Italy that can turn ugly. And then next year, we have elections in France. So there is plenty to worry about.
Charles Weiplatz, it's wonderful to speak to you today. We spoke with Paul DeGuire yesterday. And so much of this is about clearing the markets and how your Europe is behind. What is the urgency of Europe clearing their markets to move forward to get to U.S.-like growth?
Well, the problem with Europe is that it's a large number of countries and everyone has its share of trouble. Today, President Obama is in Greece, which is a very, very troubled country. Interestingly, he's been calling for debt restructuring, public debt restructuring in Greece. He's absolutely right, but the others don't want, and his next trip to Germany, he might raise the issue with Chancellor Merkel. He will be told no way. So that's one issue. But, you know, if you think about my own country, France, the labor market is pretty much in a mess. The government is huge and has been running a deficit since 1973. The list of things that have to be done in every country is pretty well known. What's missing is the politicians' readiness to do that. And I think when they watch what's happening in the U.S., they are even less willing to tackle any of the real issues.
How are they hearing what President Obama has to say on this trip in light of what happened here in the U.S. Last week? How is his message being interpreted, do you think?
Well, it's a goodbye message. People in Europe like the Obama way more than the Americans, I think. They are sad to see him go, and they are sad to see him being replaced by Trump. They are very worried about that, by the way. But you know, when he goes and makes great speeches about democracy and all of that, that's beautiful, but everybody knows that. Everybody knows that democracy is a very complex thing to make work. And at the time when the population in Europe, pretty much like in the U.S., a significant segment of the population is really upset about what has been their lot for the last 20 or 30 years, it's very, very, very hard to think about good outcomes.
Charles Weiplot's with us, of course. He is joining us by phone from France. It's great to have you with us again here. Let's talk a little bit about productivity. We're focused here on manufacturing in the U.S., but when you look at it more broadly, when you look at the state of manufacturing globally, what do you see?
Well, we had a major slowdown in productivity for the last 15, 20 years. One reason is that industry is shrinking and services are increasing, and services are typically low productivity gains or zero productivity gains. So this shifting production in production pattern through the developed world is a major source of low productivity gains.
Is it because there's too much money sloshing around? Is it just we're paying the price of capital deepening, of just overinvestment?
I don't think there has been overinvestment. Quite to the contrary, since the crisis in 2008, investment has been extremely low, extremely depressed. There are many discussions about why. I tend to believe that the poor overall growth pattern in the developed country has discouraged firms from investing, and that's weighing on productivity gains. You're right.
When you look at the complement of what the ECB is considering when it meets at the beginning of December, how heavily does productivity weigh when they're looking at the data?
I don't think they are very worried about that. Maybe they should, but I think they are very worried that inflation is stuck not far from zero and has been there for the last 3 years. They want to kick up growth, but that's not happening easily.
Charles Weiplot, and with a shout out to John Silvia of Wells Fargo, with your work, Professor Weiplot, on labor mobility, as we have economic slowdown, disinflation, we become rigid as a society. How critical is that idea, that dream of moving to a new place? How does that fold into European and, for that matter, U.S. economics?
Well, we have in most European countries very rigid markets, so it's not only that people don't move from one country to another, they don't even move within their own countries, or they move much less than the U.S. worker used to move. So that's been known for decades before we started the monetary union, and it was clear that this was one of the drawbacks of having a common currency. But to me, that's not the most important issue. To me, the most important issue is that in many countries, labor markets are frozen. It's hard to fire people, so firms don't hire. There are, in some countries, minimum wages are very high, so they are discouraging employment of non-qualified workers. Dismissals are very difficult, very costly, and legally uncertain, and so on and so forth. So the problem really is at the national level these labor markets just don't function generate their machinery to create unemployment.
I don't know if you thought about this, but if we get Trump inflation, if we get some form of stimulus and reflation within the United States, do we just presume economic growth that raises wages, or is there the real risk here, stag wageflation, where we've got inflation with no real wage increase?
Well, as you know, the mystery is why wage inflation is not higher in the U.S., given that the unemployment rate is very low. There are continuous debates about why it is the case. I think the silver lining of Trump is that if he does it, he might pump up government spending on infrastructure, increase the deficit. That would be good news for the world over, because it would mean more growth in the U.S., a return of inflation in the U.S. We all need to see some inflation up from the zero levels we have had. So there is a little bit of silver lining out there, depending on what the next president will do or not do.
Charles Weiplatz, we talk about a pause here in the U.S. Among policymakers as they wait to see what kind of infrastructure package President-elect Donald Trump will be able to get through the Congress, and how that might affect monetary policy. How do you see that playing out in Europe, a similar sort of wait-and-see approach?
Yeah, everybody's is mesmerized by the political situation in the U.S. A great number of economists, at least, had been calling for the U.S. to pump up public investment in infrastructure. But as we know, Obama had exactly zero chance of passing that through Congress. I am not sure that Trump will be able to do much better with his Congress, but I certainly wish him good luck.
You mentioned this a moment ago. Our colleague Tracy Alloway tweeting out a timetable from J.P. Morgan here of what electoral events we will have here in 2017 in Europe, ranging from primaries in France to the Italian referendum to an Austrian presidential election, a German presidential election, and general elections in the Netherlands. It's a busy year, 2017. What does Europe look like after that year is done?
Oh, God. That's a scary question. It's likely that the Austrians will elect a Nazi president. That wouldn't be the first time. They already did it 15 or 20 years ago. So that's one thing. In the Netherlands, there is a very virulent far-right, reasonably racist party, which is going up and up and up. In Germany, well, maybe Merkel will still be the miraculous chancellor she has been and win it. And in Germany, in France, as you may know, there is a serious challenge from the far right, Marine Le Pen. I personally don't believe she has any chance, but I also believe Trump had zero chance, so I wouldn't bet on it.
Yeah, well, you had a lot of company in that. Professor Weiplatz, thank you so much. With the Graduate Institute, Geneva. David, our next guest, I'm thrilled he's on, because we have not been good about commodities. We are in the surveillance commodity timeout chair.
Amid the blur that you described, Tom, we have not talked enough about oil and other commodities, as you say. I'm pleased to bring in Dane Davis now. He is a commodities analyst at Barclays. As I look at oil here, Brent at 46.67, WTI at 45.40. Dane, great to have you with us.
Glad to be here.
Let's start with the big question here. We've seen what's happened in the equities market since Donald Trump was elected. What have we seen in the commodities space broadly? What kind of moves have we seen?
Well, to put it quite shortly, Donald Trump, through his election, has made metals great again. And I'm being cheeky here, but
he has a hat, Tom. It says that.
Yeah. No, but what we've seen is a massive rally across the entire complex of metals. And it's wide-ranging. It's not just iron ore. It's steel. It's copper. It's zinc and the like. Now, this rally has started to peter out recently. But since its election, there's just been a massive increase in the metals complex.
Yeah, looking at the timing here, what do you make of it? How closely can you tie these two things together? Obviously, investors placing a big bet here on the fact that Donald Trump has said he wants to get an infrastructure bill through Congress that could have an effect on metals prices. Do you draw the correlation that closely?
Well, I think when it comes to commodities, you have to be careful of disentangling causal relationships, right? I think it's very easy for me to come on here and say, yep, Donald Trump, it's all him. But in actuality, I think a closer look at the data and the price movement shows that the prices for the metals complex in particular, they were rallying before the election of Donald Trump. Now, that tells me, given that very few people thought he was able to win, that it's not a Donald Trump thing. What I think is going on here is I think that this is a China story. So the Chinese economy has actually come in quite strongly in 2016. And I think that's leading to a rally in commodities.
Dane, I've got a copper chart which shows a rally. And really, it's through 2016, range-bound, and then up we go with the recent news. All of that's great. I'll put out the copper chart, folks, out on Twitter under B Surveillance. But is it a breakout of what is a five-year-old bear market? I don't see it technically. Is it?
We don't know yet. Copper has been really interesting. You identified something I think that's quite important. The other metals were rallying earlier into this year, yet copper was lagging. And if you believe the Dr. Copper thesis, whereas copper is the best tracker for the macroeconomy, that tells you something. That tells you that in 2016, we had a global economy that was still stuck in mediocre growth, and we had a Chinese economy that was returning to growth, and it was growing, but yet the market wasn't really certain about it. I think as we go forward, I would say follow the copper price among all the metals, because that's going to tell you what's going on. The Chinese property market has been reheated. That is what's triggered the iron ore rise. It triggered the steel rise, and now it's starting to trigger the other metals to increase. If that property market, though, shows signs of slowing down, we could be back where we were at the beginning of this year. It's a rally built on very tenuous grounds.
Agreed. I strongly agree with that. And I just, you know, I just want to frame through the Barclays lens and all the different people you've got telling you what to do. You are not calling this a commodity breakout. I want to be clear on that.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely clear. I think that there's still a lot that we haven't yet determined. I think the property market within China, I think that's number one. Number two, returning to Trump is, you know, there's a lot of hype about his infrastructure plans. We don't yet know what those infrastructure plans will be. Moreover, the market is focusing, I think, on the good things about the Trump's plan, but less on the bad things or the less desirable things. For example, if Trump threatens the global trade order, that's going to have knock-on effects in the world's largest market for metals consumption, China. I mean, you can imagine a trade war would have terrible effects onto the Chinese economy. It could also affect other emerging markets such as Mexico and Brazil. So whereas we might see a gain in metals consumption in the U.S., we could see a fall in other markets, and you could actually have a net decline. Now, that's not what we're calling for, but that's a possibility and something to keep in mind as we cut through the euphoria that we've been seeing.
Yeah, Dane Davis, in the latest Barclays commodity note, you described that tension very well. I'll let Tom use his standard caveat here about respecting the copyright of the guest, but check out the note if you can. Seek it out from Barclays. You mentioned the Chinese property market. What does what does Chinese policy look like right now when it comes to economic stimulus?
Great question. So I think it's important to go back to 2015. In 2015, there were very real concerns of a hard landing. I talked to a lot of clients that were concerned that the Chinese economy would actually go negative. We were in a very different environment. Automobile production was down in the first 9 months of the year in 2015. The real estate market was showing severe signs of weakness. Then what the Chinese did in the very beginning of this year is they played a song with a familiar tune. They essentially loosened up their credit bubble. They loosened up credit standards, loaning standards, and they allowed people to invest and buy homes. Now, this had the very positive effect in the short term of 2016 of boosting construction. But as we start to look into the forward, there's a real question here of how many times can you stimulate your way to growth? How many times can you reheat the property market? I think it's likely that it cools as we go into 17 and 18. And moreover, I think that there's the very hard limit of demography. You know, the Chinese population is aging. A lot of the growth is already behind it in terms of its population bubble. So that puts another hard limit on the property market.
Dane, I'm looking at trade figures here, trade figures for October, Chinese trade figures, and they look disappointing to me. How much of a red flag is that for you?
I think you need more than one data point to make a trend. The weakness in October, I think it is concerning, but it's not yet concerning enough, and it's not yet confirmed by more trade data points to be a worrying trend. But I think it is something that goes back to my key thesis here is let's hold up. You know, we've seen this massive rally in copper going from 208 to 250. Let's just recheck fundamentals, look at what the data is actually telling us and not what, you know, we might think may happen in the future.
Help me with the esoterics. I, you know, I've spent too much money in London. Can I make it back in zinc? I mean, we don't talk enough on this show, David Gura, about zinc.
We definitely don't. And there's a reason. There's a reason for that.
You know, I think that is a very esoteric question. And here would be my answer to you. I think that we're in a new era of commodities. And so when you look at something like copper or zinc or nickel or that, it's no longer the rising China lifts all boats. I think that the price outlook for various commodities, zinc included, copper included, iron ore, will be increasingly determined by supply fundamentals. Look for those markets which have very tight supply fundamentals, which are facing problems in getting production into the market, which are facing the threat of resource nationalism. Those commodities, I think, are going to be your best chance going forward. The other commodities, though, that have new supply coming online in 15, 16, new supply coming online in the future, iron ore, I think, is a good example of this. I think those commodities are the most pressure as we move forward.
I want to get to oil here in just a minute, but maybe one more question here about metals. What are we seeing in terms of disruption when it comes to demand for copper? I know that there were strikes in Indonesia and labor disputes in Peru. These things have an effect on the price of copper, or are they pretty at the margins?
I think they do have a psychological effect on the price of copper. So you're right. We've been having – it's been a quiet year so far, but then in this third quarter, going into the fourth quarter, disruptions started to suddenly tick up. There were storms in Australia that knocked out several copper mines. There were labor disputes in Indonesia at the Grasberg mine. There's been issues with the Philippines, and they have a very – new regulatory climate. So there's been more disruptions to production in copper and in other metals. But I think that doesn't really necessarily affect the balances today. I think that does, though, give you a psychological argument for higher prices. Whether or not it actually is impacting the true balances, it's hard to determine. But I think it does give, you know, a market boost.
Dane Davis with his fundamentals on the metals and, of course, his work with Michael Cohen and others at Barclays on oil as well. Well, Dane Davis with us with Barclays. And, you know, we're lucky, folks, that Dane Davis, well, he, like, deals in the land of rebar and copper and palladium. Down the hall is Michael Cohen, Warren Russell, Miswin Mahesh. They look at oil. Help us here, Dane, and this is within the microeconomics of commodities. I mean, like aluminum is aluminum, and it's totally different. There's fewer barriers to entry, et cetera, than copper. What's your interpretation of oil microeconomics right now? Is it a whole new terrain because of U.S. fracking where the rules that guys like you use are forever changed?
Well, I think the way to address this is to look at the supply side. And let's do some comparisons here. Let's talk about oil and let's talk about natural gas and copper. For copper, we haven't really had any revolutions in the production of copper mining since the 1980s. In the 1980s, they created a new process using various acids where they could extract copper from deposits that were previously uneconomical. But since then, really, if you want to get copper today, it's the same way you got copper 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. You dig a massive pit in the ground, and you just mine it out. Now, when we talk about natural gas or if we talk about oil, we've seen massive revolutions on the supply side for both of those commodities. And so I think when you look at prices today and you look at trying to understand price action, I think it's important to understand we're in a new world with, say, natural gas production. You know, I'm from Ohio, Northeast Ohio, and I've witnessed firsthand the revolution that we've seen thanks to shale gas technologies and the transformation of the Ohio and Pennsylvania economies.
I thought you were going to say the Cleveland Indians.
No. You know, my father's actually a Yankees fan, so I we're Yankees fans in the Davis household.
So he needs protection in Ohio.
He does. Right? No, but in oil, it's the same thing too. I mean, if you go back to 2007 and 2008, there were the concerns of peak oil, and that, which was once a fringe theory, was seriously being discussed in the mainstream. And then we've had the tight oil in the U.S. revolutionize the market. So when we look at the microeconomics of commodities, whether it's oil, natural gas, copper, or some of the metals, it's important to keep in mind, how are these commodities brought to the market, and have there been any technological innovations in bringing those commodities to the market?
Dan Davis, I'm looking at Brent here, $46.52 a barrel. Let's look at that through the prism of this meeting taking place in Vienna at the end of the month. Is optimism based into that price or pessimism?
Well, I think when it comes to OPEC, I think the key thing here is that you have to separate rhetoric from reality. And, there's two questions here. One, whether or not OPEC comes to an agreement. And then the second question is, are they actually able to carry through any agreements that they reach, right? So we are in a new world. Going back to what I just said with regards to oil supply, it's no longer the situation that we found ourselves in the 1970s or 1980s. There's new ways to get oil to the market, and there's new areas where we get oil to the market. And so when you have an economics, going back to microeconomics, when you have an organization, a cartel, which controls supply, they already have a difficult time in, rationing supply among the different producers. There's strong incentives to cheat. But when you have a market when that cartel has a declining share of overall output, the incentives become that much more stronger. So I think the real question is, and not to avoid your question, is are they able to enforce any agreements that they come to?
Dane, one last question. I want to revisit the Arch call, which is the China commodity boom, the boom of the last X number of years. Are we back on the track of what has been well over a half century of just general commodity deflation due to technological progress and due to improved processes worldwide? Are we back to the normal?
Well, I'm going to sound like an economist here and give a classic economist answer. It depends. It depends. It depends on the commodity. Look, I think for something like copper or zinc or that, where the supply side is constrained, I think that you might not see strong deflation. But for other commodities where we've seen technological revolutions, you might. And I think, too, the demand outlook for commodities are very different. If you take aluminum and copper, I was just in London for LME Week. The outlook for aluminum is very, very bright. There's the substitution effect. We're using aluminum in vehicles. We're using aluminum in our iPhones and our laptops and the like. So the demand growth there looks to be pretty strong. Copper, surprisingly, despite being the macro metal, the demand outlook isn't that great. Looking at 1.5 to 2% growth annually per year. So it all depends on, the particulars of each commodity. I think that's the key message. Look at each commodity on its own.
Okay.
Don't view it as an asset class.
Dane Davis, thank you so much with Barclays.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on iTunes, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm out on Twitter at Tom Keen. David Gura is at David Gura. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio. Who you put your trust in matters. Investors have put their trust in independent registered investment advisors to the tune of $4 trillion. Why? Learn more at findyourindependentadvisor.com.